From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jimmy Wales, the founder of one of the most popular sites on the internet, Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia. It draws on the expertise of thousands of people. Anyone can write or revise an entry, and that can lead to some misinformation. We learn something shocking, but not true, about our own executive producer, Danny Miller. The three comics known as Human Giant first circulated their short sketch comedy films on the internet. Now they have a new MTV show. We'll meet them, Aziz Ansari, Rob Hubel, and Paul Scheer. And music critic Milo Miles reviews three CDs collecting the work of Nigeria's juju superstar, King Sunny Ade. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the founder of one of the most popular sites on the internet, Wikipedia. It's an online encyclopedia. Unlike the bound volumes of encyclopedias we grew up with, Wikipedia entries can be written or changed by anyone who visits the website. This openness has led to an enormous number of entries, drawing on the expertise of far more people than any traditional encyclopedia. On the other hand, it's resulted in inaccuracies, which have led many readers to treat entries with some skepticism. The satirical newspaper The Onion recently ran this article: Wikipedia, the online reader-edited encyclopedia, honored the 750th anniversary of American independence on July 25th with a special featured section. And Stephen Colbert has lampooned Wikipedia a few times in his daily essay The Word on the Colbert Report.
Last year, I defined the concept of wikiality. When Wikipedia becomes our most trusted reference source, reality is just what the majority agrees upon. To inaugurate wikiality, I called on you heroes to change Wikipedia entries to say that elephant populations had tripled. You responded, the entries were changed, and Wikipedia crashed. Now, I thought that was the end. But lo and behold, look what that page said just last week. Thanks to the works of Stephen Colbert, the population of elephants has tripled in the past 10 years. We saved the elephant again, America. More proof of what happens when you bring democracy to information.
Despite the criticisms, Wikipedia's founder, Jimmy Wales, is committed to the philosophy behind Wikipedia.
The larger philosophy is we're a core part of the free culture movement, and this is it really comes originally from the free software movement, which people also know of as open source. The basic idea is that for all of our work, people can copy it, modify it, redistribute it. They can do all these things commercially or non-commercially. We're really all about building the creative commons, essentially, the base of raw cultural materials that people can build on for whatever other purposes they might have.
And there's no advertising on Wikipedia. Is that by design? You don't want ads?
Yeah, the Wikipedia is owned and operated by the Wikimedia Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization I founded. And we kind of view ourselves as being something like the Red Cross for Information. In other words, we are a charity. We exist on donations from the general public. And, for us, advertising just wouldn't really suit our style. It's not something that we're really interested in pursuing right now.
How many entries would you say Wikipedia has now in English?
In the English Wikipedia, there are just below 1.75 million. So I'm not sure exactly when, but it's sometime in the next few days we're going to be at 1.75 million entries. But the interesting thing about that number is that the English Wikipedia is really less than one-third of the total work. There are far more entries in all the different languages of the world. We have more than 125 languages now that have at least 1,000 articles. We've got over 500,000 in German. Several other languages are also quite big. It's really a global movement. There are people all over the world who are building out Wikipedia in their own language.
Now, one of the things that makes Wikipedia just like a little controversial is that it's not written, the entries aren't written necessarily by experts in the field. It isn't edited by a panel of experts. Basically, anybody can write an entry. So how does anybody go about writing an entry?
So the software that we use is called Wiki. And Wiki is a word that comes from a Hawaiian word, wiki-wiki, which means quick. And the idea is quick collaboration. So the basic idea of any wiki is that it's very easy to get involved, very easy to get started. Anyone can edit. And then instead of having gatekeepers preventing people from edit, instead we give the community the tools they need to control the quality. So we have the ability to roll back to previous versions if somebody messes something up. The administrators in the community can block people if they're causing trouble. We can temporarily lock pages, although we don't like to do that very often. And so it's a whole suite of software tools that puts the control of the website really into the hands of the users.
So who has the job of editing the new entries and what is the editing process like? And is there any fact-checking that's part of the editing?
Right. So the editing job is everyone's, basically. Anyone who comes to the website can participate in the editing process of new entries or old entries. It's a very open-ended process. Nothing is ever really considered to be done. The fact-checking that goes on is pretty extensive, but it's done live in real time by the community. So people are always discussing and debating entries, trying to decide if there's a good source for something. If there's a controversial fact or claim, then the community will take it to the discussion page and try to figure out where it comes from and what to do about it. It's really a very vibrant community process.
But don't you have a staff that's partially responsible for this too?
Well, not really. There are seven full-time positions at the foundation, but they're mainly tasked with, we've got a couple of software developers, somebody doing grants. It's financial, legal, technical support. The actual editing, the actual management of the website on a day-to-day basis is really fully in the hands of the volunteer community.
You know, everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, many people who have entries under their name in Wikipedia have like at least one fact or factoid that is wrong. Sometimes it's slightly wrong. Sometimes it's incredibly wrong. So I thought I'd give one that relates to fresh air. As we record this, the entry includes some links, and one of the links is to our executive producer, Danny Miller. Now, if you tap on the link to Danny Miller from the fresh air entry on Wikipedia, you will read this. Danny Miller, when Danny was 10 years old, he murdered an elderly woman by the name of Lizzie Parks, smothering her with a pillow before playing with her deceased body. Now, that's the first thing I saw when I opened the page. Higher up on the page, it explains that Danny Miller is a fictional character in a 2001 novel called Border Crossing by Pat Barker. But anyways, our Danny Miller has nothing to do with this fictional Danny Miller. And
interesting. Yeah. So I can see how that happened.
How did that happen?
One of the things that's interesting about the way our software works is when you're editing an entry, all you have to do to make a link to a different entry is you just enclose any words in square brackets. So if I'm writing about fresh air and I type Danny Miller, well, I just put a couple of brackets around his name, and that automatically creates a link to the article Danny Miller, which may exist somewhere else on the website. In this case, it sounds like there are two Danny Millers. There's a fictional character, and then there's the person from Fresh Air. Normally what happens in a case like this, someone will notice it and they'll realize, hey, this isn't the same person. This fictional character probably doesn't really have much to do with Fresh Air. And they'll create what we call a disambiguation page. So somebody will go in and say, well, we need a page that says Danny Miller may refer to the following possibilities. And normally there would be, well, in a case of a name like Danny Miller, which is a fairly common name, there would be those two, but there might be actually a lot more than that. There might be, some politician Danny Miller or a novelist Danny Miller. So normally there would be a whole set of people that would be a disambiguation link. But that's basically how that happens. The easy linking makes it easy to accidentally link to the wrong one.
So what do you think? Should we fix this ourselves?
You could. You could. It's actually an interesting question when people see something that's an error. But it's on a topic that they actually have some personal interest in, either your own biography or your company or something like this. We don't really have a hard and fast rule that says you absolutely shouldn't, but it's something that we ask people to be really careful about because it's really hard to be objective about yourself or your own show. Something like that, it's clearly obvious. Somebody accidentally made a link to the wrong person, and so you could do a search and find out if the correct Danny Miller has an article in Wikipedia, and if so, you would just change the link to be the right place. But the other thing you could do is just go to the discussion page, click on the discussion page and add a comment at the bottom and say, gee, I don't think the Danny Miller that you're linking to is the right one because that's a fictional character, not a real person.
And who would read that?
Oh, so the discussion pages are read, anybody can read it, but this is something that the active users of the site are constantly monitoring, talk pages.
So these are self-appointed editors that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, within the community, people come and go all the time, but it's a really tight-knit community. We're very much in communication with each other through mailing lists, through the wiki itself, through chat rooms. And so this is the people that I refer to as really the core community. So those would be the people who really are responsible for Wikipedia on a day-to-day basis.
My guest is Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jimmy Wales, and he's the founder of Wikipedia, the internet encyclopedia. Now, there's like one particularly infamous hoax on Wikipedia, you know, while we're talking about mistakes. And this is with John Siegenthaler, who was the founding editor of USA Today and formerly was an administrative assistant to Bobby Kennedy. And at one point, his bio on Wikipedia said that at one time in his life, he was thought to have been directly involved in the President Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy assassinations. That's
right.
Apparently like a really major, not only mistake, a hoax. I mean, somebody put that in knowing that it was a hoax.
Yeah.
Tell us the story of how that was discovered and what happened.
So what happened was someone who lives in the same town as John Siegenthaler thought it would be funny to play a prank on his friend, and so he made an edit to Wikipedia to create an article about John Siegenthaler and added this incorrect information, and then he basically forgot about it. He didn't go and clean up after himself after he was done, and so it just sat there. And what was interesting about this particular case is that the article wasn't placed into a category. It wasn't linked from anywhere else. It was kind of off to itself within Wikipedia. So it slipped through some of the normal processes. I'd mentioned earlier the page where people can see the new pages. So it was a new page, but somehow it slipped through the cracks for the new pages patrol. So basically, it just sat there for 4 months until Mr. Siegenthaler noticed it, and he called us up. And, I talked to him on the phone. We had it fixed within 10 minutes after he notified me. And then soon after, he wrote a really scathing editorial about Wikipedia in USA Today, and it became a big news story. It was a really terrible mistake. The irony of it is, Mr. Siegenthaler himself has been a very staunch defender of the First Amendment, and that's been a big part of his career. And then, of course, he was a member of the Kennedy administration. He was actually a pallbearer, I believe, at Bobby Kennedy's funeral. So, it was quite upsetting to him. The person who put in the information was tracked down and apologized, and it was kind of an embarrassing incident for him. He didn't really mean any harm. He was just some guy who works in an office, goofing around on the internet, which is unfortunate. But since then, we've really tried to focus a lot of attention within the community on these issues of biographies of living people, because these are really the most difficult and potentially problematic articles in Wikipedia. There's a lot of things you can get wrong inadvertently or if some malicious person comes in. So we've really beefed up our policies about that. So the community has become more and more vigilant about policing the biographies, pulling out unsourced information, positive or negative. If it seems a little questionable, people will pull it out much more aggressively than they would in the past to try to deal with that kind of problem so that we can, remain as reliable as we possibly can be.
But there must be a lot that slips through the cracks.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, it's a really interesting phenomenon. If you describe Wikipedia to people who've never seen it, or if you kind of roll back your mind and imagine you've never seen it before, and you say, well, it's supposed to be an encyclopedia, but it's open to editing by anybody. Anybody can come and change anything at any time. It sounds like a recipe for complete, total disaster. It's a completely insane idea. And yet, most of Wikipedia is kind of okay. You know, it has its problems, but most of it's pretty good. And the community is really vigilant.
I'm going to stop you right there. Uh-huh. It's the most that I find really problematic. I mean, I refer to Wikipedia a lot. And I sometimes feel like, I bet nearly everything in this entry is accurate, but there's going to be, you know, a few things that maybe aren't, and I'm not going to know the difference. And that's what worries me.
Well, that's true, of course, for any kind of source. I mean, if you look at Britannica, there are lots of errors in Britannica. You look in the daily newspaper, there's always going to be errors. So I think we need to be concerned, very much concerned, about the level of accuracy of Wikipedia. But at the same time, I always caution people, don't hold it to an impossible standard. But let's talk about, you know, a possible standard, like how good is it and how effective can it be, and what if something is a little bit wrong? And I think these are very interesting questions. This is something that the community really grapples with on a daily basis. How do we continue the ongoing improvement of quality of Wikipedia? What are the things that we need to change in the software? Where do the real problems arise, and how do we start to deal with those problems? The one thing that we can't do, that we don't want to do, is throw out the baby with the bathwater. What I mean by that is we know that our process works pretty darn good, and it's really sparked this amazing phenomenon of this enormous, very high-quality website. And so as we make changes to policy, as we make changes to the software, we want to be really careful to preserve what's good, but then also find the tools that we need as a community to make the site even better.
Now, the New Yorker had an article on Wikipedia over the summer, and that article reported that in some political campaigns, candidates have changed the Wikipedia entries of their opponents to emphasize, like, corruption in their opponent's record and things like that. Are you aware of these kind of, like, Wikipedia battles during political campaigns?
Yeah, it's a relatively minor matter, and we take a kind of a we try to take a balanced view of it. In other words, on the one hand, we absolutely want to discourage campaigns from coming in and trying to use Wikipedia as a propaganda tool or a battleground for their fights. At the same time, you know, Wikipedia has now become really part of the fabric of our social dialogue, and I think it's important that if people, even politicians, have an interest in seeing a full discussion and debate of the issues. It's just really a matter of when you have a self-interest, when you have a particular participation in something, the better way to interact with the community that's more respectful to the people who are writing the encyclopedia is to go to the discussion page and make your case there rather than get involved in editing yourself. The worst cases are when somebody comes in, they edit something that they have a personal interest in or some kind of stake in, but they try to do so on the sly or surreptitiously pretending to be someone else. That's clearly unethical, and that's something that we would definitely discourage.
So let me give you an example. If you search George W. Bush, that's an example of an entry where there'd be different points of view of how that entry should read, you know, and describing his life and determining what to emphasize and what to mention, what not to mention at all. Is that an example of an entry that has had a lot of changes to it with people from the left and people from the right wanting their version of his story to be in the entry?
Yes, of course. The George Bush entry is the number one most edited entry at Wikipedia, has been for quite some time. But on a big public entry and something really active like George Bush, then yes, of course, we do have people who come in and occasionally try to make it, you know, incredibly one-sided or something like that.
Tell us how you deal with that. You know, with somebody like the President Bush entry, will you have people with agendas or strong points of view who keep changing it? You say it's the most revised entry. So,
right.
So who finally determines how it's going to read? What's that process?
Well, so the process is there are about 1,000 administrators who are elected from the community. In the English Wikipedia, and every language has their own administrators. But the administrators really keep an eye on things like that. We really don't like it at all if we see, you know, the left and the right battling back and forth, switching an entry back and forth, because that isn't a productive dialogue. What we want to do is push people to say, look, come to the talk page, let's discuss what the issue is. And it turns out that far more people are in agreement with the idea that an encyclopedia entry should be neutral than the very tiny number of people who are really trying to very heavily push an agenda and won't settle for anything else.
Would you guess that somebody on Karl Rove's staff reads the president's Wikipedia entry every day to make sure there isn't anything there that they find incorrect?
I'm quite certain. I won't name names, but I've met many politicians who tell me that their staff watches the Wikipedia entry every day.
Really?
I think it's quite common, particularly as we've become very important and well-known, for people to keep an eye on it.
Does the amount of information that you have to deal with and that Wikipedia is responsible for ever give you a really bad headache?
Yeah, and, you know, this is actually one of the things that I think is really interesting. That is the differential impact of Wikipedia in different languages. So in English, I think one of the great values that Wikipedia has for people is that it does give you a concise summary. It's an encyclopedia. So if you really want to know, you know, what happened at Tiananmen Square, you can go and in the space of a few pages, you get the basic information you need instead of being overwhelmed with thousands of essays and articles and so forth. On the other hand, in the developing world, in many of the languages that we're very active in, Wikipedia serves the opposite purpose. People who have no access to information, they really don't have the flood of information that we have, find Wikipedia very useful because, well, for the first time, they've got some information and it's a nice summary. So for me, I think that's a really interesting difference in how Wikipedia can impact different people.
Well, Jimmy Wales, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, well, it's great fun.
Jimmy Wales is the founder of the online encyclopedia Wikipedia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year, and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews three collections of the music of Nigeria's juju superstar King Sunny Ade. And we meet the three comics behind Human Giant, the new sketch comedy series of short films on MTV. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. MTV's new sketch comedy show, Human Giant, features three comics and actors, my guests Aziz Ansari, Rob Ubel, and Paul Scheer. They first circulated their short films on the internet and have performed live at the New York club Upright Citizens Brigade. Welcome to Fresh Air. How do you describe your short films to people who haven't seen them?
It's always a tough question because we want to make sure that we don't come off sounding cheesy when we describe them. But I think that they're, you know, very like high energy, fun films. Like we really try to have a beginning, middle, and end. We try to make them a little bit different than sketches.
I think they're also absurd too. I think they often veer into the land of absurdity, and yeah, I mean, our main thing is just to make them funny and fast, get in and get out very quickly.
Yeah, because we find that the problem with sketch comedy lately is that things just go on forever. And what we try to do is just try to, you know, get people to laugh and then move on to the next thing.
One of your films that I think was really noticed was The Worst Mixtape. Would one of you describe the premise of this?
Well, basically the premise was that me and Rob have a contest to see who can make the worst mixtape ever. And Paul would be the judge. We each get to choose five songs. And then whoever lost the mixtape contest would be forced to walk around New York blasting the mixtape from a boombox.
Which is a ridiculous position to be in, as you prove in the little film where Aziz, you're the guy with the really large boombox having to play this stuff. So to talk about what you decided to put on the mix.
Well, what's interesting is we did it before we got the show, actually, and a lot of the songs that were originally used weren't clearable. So, like, Paula Cole, for example.
Was that why it changed? Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, like, in the original thing, the closing song was the Dawson's Creek theme by Paula Cole, the song called I Don't Wanna Wait.
I Don't Wanna Wait!
Yeah, and Paula Cole apparently didn't want to be on the world's worst mixtape. Neither did Gloria Estefan, neither did Crazy Town. So we were just scrambling, like, okay, so OMC will let us use How Bizarre? They're like, yes, yes, they'll let us use it for this amount of money. Okay, all right, Aziz, go out with a boombox and play that. And I was like, oh, gosh, not again. And so, you know, OMC, How Bizarre, what else ended up making it?
What was that song at the end, the like the very heart?
Total Eclipse
song?
Of the Heart.
Total Eclipse of the Heart, that's a good one.
And the one song we got to keep from the original, I think, was Kiss Me by Sixpence None the Richer.
It's pretty funny to walk around the city and see the reactions that you get blasting that music from very proudly from a boombox.
How stupid did you feel lugging around this really absurdly large boombox playing not good music?
Well, it wasn't a fun thing to do. It was weird. The first time I did it, I didn't really care because, like, you know, I wasn't really known at all walking around in the city and stuff. But the second time when I had to do it for the clearable songs, like, it was kind of like, oh, no, like, people that don't know who I am are just going to think, oh, here's this jerk, you know, with his boombox. And the people that do know who I am, like, you know, we have a mild amount of celebrity in New York, I guess, and it's just like, oh, there he is again, Mr. Funny Man. Yeah, we get it, buddy. You and your little mixtape. Take it easy, all right? We've seen the bit.
Yeah. Well, and another sketch that you've done is the Shutterbugs. This is like the Shutterbug Agency. It's a really, like, high-powered, hardball agency for actors, except all the actors you represent are these little children. Can you talk about coming up with this idea? You've done two Shutterbug sketches.
Yeah, Shutterbugs came originally out of an idea. Aziz and I had done that on stage. We all met over at this theater here in New York called the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, and we all started performing comedy together over there. And Aziz hosts a weekly show over there called Crash Test, and it's a show where they have different stand-ups and you can try out different material and stuff like that. And I, the very first time he did the show, I co-hosted with him, and we wanted to do this bit because I had a pile of these kids' headshots and at my house, and I found them one time in a friend's office who does some casting. And the pictures on these headshots of these little kids are so cute. You just want to, you know, you want to hug them so hard it would probably kill them. But they're so cute, and it's so ridiculous, and they're so filled with hope that we thought it would be really fun to make fun of them and to completely rip them apart. So we did this bit on stage where we flashed all their headshots on an overhead, and then we really criticized their headshots. and eventually that onstage bit, we sort of spun that out into the real world where we could sort of exist in some sort of world. And we thought the best world for that would be the talent agency world. And so we formed this this little fake world called the Shutterbugs Talent Agency. And that's what it is, basically. We wheel and deal with tiny little kids, and they're cute as can be, and we just rip them apart.
Now, the funny thing was, too, when we did these before we had the MTV show, we didn't have access to casting, you know, professional children actors. So we actually called in all favors from our friends and had them bring in their own children. and we just have to bring them in and just like yell at these like little kids. And it was even funnier because they just, you know, these kids aren't actors. They didn't know what was going on, but it was great.
And we ran into some of the same legal mumbo jumbo when we got the television show for MTV that, you know, little did we know that, oh, now we have to go and we have to find those kids and get their permission to put those images on television, because those were just strangers to us. You know, we just found these this pile of headshots.
And so there we are 6 months later or a year later calling up kids that live now in, like, the Midwest. And it's like, oh, you know, Johnny's gotten out of acting, but I guess we'll ask him if he wants to be in your sketch.
Kids are just – we have, like, PAs, like, going on MySpace looking for Cody Austin and all these kids and just trying to track them down.
We found them all. And they all agreed, actually.
It was amazing.
They're nicer than Gloria Estefan.
They're way nicer than Gloria Estefan.
My guests are the three comics and actors in the group Human Giant. Their new sketch comedy show, Human Giant, is shown Thursday nights on MTV. Here's a clip from the short film we were just talking about, Shutterbugs.
We're the top talent agency in New York.
Of course.
We're able to open doors for our clients. Now, if you don't have the talent to walk through those doors, why do we even have a relationship?
I think what Bill is saying is that if it was gonna happen for you, it would have happened by now.
Look, this is a little bit harsh, but frankly, at this point in your career, I think it's safe to say you're a has-been. You're old news.
Your relationship with Shutterbugs is over. Look, if there's anything you want to say to us, now is the time to say it.
Look, you know what? I don't even want to hear it. Just get the hell out of our office.
Just get out, please.
More with the comics from Human Giant after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the three comics from the new MTV sketch comedy series, Human Giant, Aziz Ansari, Rob Hubel, and Paul Scheer. Do you want to describe your new sketch that you just put on the internet, Lil 9/11?
Oh, well, basically we had this idea that the Shutterbugs are idiots, and if they ever came up with a movie idea, it would be the most offensive, terrible movie of all time, and of course that would be Lil 9/11,
which is kind of in the style of that movie Bugsy Malone, where they take an adult story, but they just cast it with children. And so, you know, in the vein of these movies that have been done about September 11th, we made a movie with children.
And basically, you know, we tried to do it. It's one of those things that that is supposed to be offensive. You know, we thought that, like, the Shutterbugs are such jerks. And they are really such idiots that this would be, in their minds, a great idea to have a Lil George Bush and a Lil Osama bin Laden. And there's a lot of revisionist history in there. Like, Lil George Bush flies off the aircraft carrier and flies over to Afghanistan and goes into a cave and gets into a fist fight with Lil Osama bin Laden.
And basically, the video is basically just Lil George Bush and Lil Osama bin Laden. And that episode of the Shutterbugs deals with the fallout of that film. The director thinks it's a terrible idea. Everyone involved with it thinks it's a terrible idea, except for these two guys.
Yeah, it basically leads, you know, not to give too much away, but it leads to their downfall. Like,
get fired, and, you know, their world falls apart because of this dumb idea.
You know, and I think we also just wanted to kind of poke fun at the, the glorification of in these movies where they make, like, an action film out of it. And, you know, so we just enjoyed that a little bit.
Yeah, I think, like, that's really more inappropriate than anything. And so, I sort of think that, you know, we've had some people be like, oh, that's really terrible that you did that. And it's supposed to be a terrible idea. I mean, that's a lot of comedy is offensive.
Can I just point out that it starts with one of the child actors reading My Pet Goat in front of a classroom? So how did you start doing these short films and putting them on the internet? Was it YouTube at first?
Originally it was. Yeah, once we all met and we came together, we basically just wanted to make some short films to show around the New York comedy scene. You know, we were all performing at a lot of different shows in New York. And there has within the, I would say, you know, the past few years, it's really become a very popular thing to make a lot of short films. And it was a great calling card, and it's kind of a great way to get your name out there and get your face out there. So it was really that. It was really for, in the beginning, it was just for fun. And, you know, we're all good friends and we hang out together a lot. And it sort of, we found our director, Jason Walliner, and he's just this really talented young director who can shoot and edit and write and kind of do everything. And we just sort of fell in with him. And so the first thing we did was Shutterbugs, and then
we moved on and made this thing called Illusionators, which Aziz and I kind of took the two lead roles in, where we played these magicians kind of parodying the David Blaine, Chris Angel type of guys. And that was actually too long to put on the internet. It was 12 minutes. And we just brought that around to colleges and played it around New York, and that got a lot of people excited. And we just finally wound up releasing it just right before the show started.
Well, when you put something on YouTube, like the sketch that you were describing before, how do people find it? I mean, you could put something on YouTube and it could get noticed, but it's more likely you're going to put something on YouTube and it'll just, no one will know it's there.
I think that we got really lucky with word of mouth. And one of the editors at YouTube took a liking to us and put us on the front page. And, you know, the front page can have anything on it. It could have like a cat, you know, sleeping in a corner, and then also, you know, an episode of Illusionators or Shutterbugs. And I think that we just had some people that were really excited by some of the stuff that we did, and they liked the quality, so it kind of got put into the right places.
You know, we were talking before about this sketch that you've done, Shutterbugs, about this talent agency where the agents work with and bully these little children actors and say things like, if it was going to happen for you, it would have happened by now. So I'm wondering if any of you have any really good agent stories to tell about how you feel like you were misunderstood or mistreated.
We all do.
Yeah, when I first went in to meet with the agent that I signed with, the agency I signed with, the agent sat me down and said, do you know that I have never used the fact that I'm an agent to get women? Because I don't need to do that. And I really, like, I thought in my mind, I was like, why is this coming up? And, you know, and then he goes, I don't want to sign people. I want to sign a zeitgeist. But I have to say that I was blown away by that. I was like, this is the most insane person I ever met. But driving home, I was like, I don't know. That kind of want to sign with these people because they're so insane. Like, if they're fighting that hard for me in the room, they might fight hard for me later on.
I'm with that agency, and I'm now dropping them as a result of that.
When I first got the agent that I'm with, I went in there with a friend of mine on The Daily Show, Rob Riggle, and I were performing as a team. And so we were going out to Hollywood, and we were having these meetings, and it's really intimidating. You know, you sit in these rooms, and there are all these really slick agents, and they're all gathered around a table in these awesome suits, and they're like, take it away, Steve. And they sort of do this very rehearsed thing where they're trying to sort of blow your mind with how amazing their agency is. So after this big presentation, I looked at Rob Riggle, and I was trying to be funny, and I said, guys, what we really want to do is we really want to do a project with Jim Belushi because we really love Jim Belushi. And I was just being sarcastic because, I'm not a huge Jim Belushi fan. And all of a sudden, this silence fell over the room and everyone just stared at me and they go, Rob, Lance represents Jim Belushi. And so, you know, I just completely insulted their like big client right to their faces. It was really embarrassing. And there was nowhere to go. You know, there's like when you insult someone that blatantly, there's no backpedaling.
Yeah. And we were also really...
Aziz, I know you majored in marketing at NYU's business school before actually like becoming a comic. Why did you want to major in marketing? I mean, there seems to be such a big difference between marketing and stand-up comedy.
Well, it was because I was doing stand-up while I was in college, and marketing was way easier than finance. I went to business school because, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I figured, oh, business school will be really relaxed. It's probably people like me, pretty, you know, chill and just trying to figure out what they're trying to do. But at Stern is not like that at all. It's all these kids that are in finance that are just trying to work at Goldman Sachs, and I was like, whoa, what is going on? And marketing seemed like the only thing where it was, you know, mildly creative or something. And I just kind of, you know, to be honest, I really just coasted through marketing while I was doing stand up. And, you know, by the time I was in my junior year, I was kind of like, yeah, I think if I keep doing the stand-up stuff. I can hopefully do something in comedy, you know, and that was kind of how it played out, I guess.
But I think I actually think that I was a marketing major too. But I do think that sort of stuff has actually helped us, because we've actually sort of had to do a lot of this stuff on our own in terms of like promotion, especially on the internet. You know, like we, you know, MTV it's a brand new show, and sometimes they're trying to figure out how to promote it. And so our ideas are very valuable as well. So I think that some of that stuff has really helped us. And like, we've been able to get in touch with a lot of different websites and people, friends of ours that blog and stuff like that, and really sort of send these little seeds out and sort of plant these little seeds all over the internet and just try to help market ourselves, you know?
Very clever. So the three of you have a real successful thing going now. I mean, you've got your new Human Giant show on MTV. But what happens if somebody kind of breaks up the act? Like if one of you becomes cast in a film that's a big hit and you go your own way? Like, have you made a pledge
Jason will be the one that, yeah, that breaks that, away. We all think Jason...
Our director is going to blow up. He'll be directing Hollywood movies in 6 months. He really is...
He's amazing.
He's amazing. right now, he you know, we left the edit suite last night at like 4:30 in the morning, and he kept going after that. So he'll
and he'd been there all day.
So he'll sleep on the couch and then get up and brush his teeth at Starbucks and then go back and start editing again. And so it's really crazy, but we think he'll be the breakout guy.
He's great. And you know, and to answer your question too, like, you know, the three of us have all done things independently before we came together. We're not like a group that, you know, evolved out of a college troupe or have been performing together for years and years. Like, you know, I think that we really enjoy doing things together, and we're very successful separately. So I think for us to keep this group going, I think it's a mixture of both at all times.
We all really are good friends, and we've been through this process now. That was, you know, it was a really hard process to write the show and to produce the show and do all that. It was a lot of fun, but it was so much work. So I think we've all become better friends, and we've become better performers, hopefully, and better writers. Mm-hmm. And you know, we all sort of pull for each other. These guys have they did a movie with Billy Bob Thornton last year, and I went in for that movie a while ago. I went in for this new Die Hard movie that's coming out, and now I'm remembering that this is a ridiculous story. I went in for the new Die Hard movie, and I was kind of like, well, this is pretty cool. They probably saw Human Giant. They're probably pretty psyched about that. I'm sure I'll get this big part. And I went in for the role was called the Pasty Faced Hacker, which I'm sure the guy had, you know, one line or something like that. And so I went in, and I go in to audition for this thing, and I sit down in this old chair, and I sit down and I start doing this very dramatic scene where I'm hacking into some computer system, and I'm like, I don't know where the codes are, Steve. We got to get the codes. We got to hack in through this firewall. And then all of a sudden, the chair that I'm sitting on completely shatters, and it was this old chair, and I just go crashing to the floor, and I thought, you know, so humiliating, because this is a major blockbuster movie. So I tried to just improvise and just roll with it. So I was like, damn it, McClane rigged the chair to blow. Can't believe it. So, you know, I thought that was pretty cool, staying in character, and the people were just like, okay, thank you very much.
So, yeah. So
we're getting all the plum rolls, yeah. Terry. You can see.
Well, you're congratulations on today. Your new prestige.
It's, oh, yeah. We're excited. We're very excited.
That's great. Well, listen, thanks so much for talking with us, and good luck at the show.
Thank you so much for having us,
Terry. It was really fun.
Aziz Ansari, Rob Hubel, and Paul Scheer are the comics and actors behind the new sketch comedy show Human Giant. The latest episode will be shown tonight on MTV. Coming up, Milo Miles on the music of Nigerian superstar King Sunny Ade. This is Fresh Air. Mm-hmm. For many veteran Afropop performers, the end of the LP era meant that back catalogs of their albums were no longer available. And for many of those musicians, there's no prospect of a CD being produced locally. Music critic Milo Miles delivers the good news that the music of one performer who made a splash in the West, Nigeria's King Sunny Ade, is being smartly preserved in the digital age.
It's not often you can pick up an ideal introduction to a major Afropop performer in just three CDs. Somebody has to boil down the often sprawling discographies and keep the finest essence in circulation in Western markets. Fortunately for Juju superstar King Sunny Ade, the Shaniki label has done the job for his 60s and 70s vintage material, and the easy-to-find import label Rass has taken care of his Western crossover sides done in the 1980s. I'm convinced Ade's Juju music has timeless appeal just as strong now as when it first cropped up in this country 25 years ago. Nigerian juju is hard to explain to outsiders, partly because it has no close Western parallel in popular music. But it's useful to think of it this way. Like rock and soul, juju is a music born in a mix of optimism, hedonism, progress, and opportunity. When stars like Ike Dairo, Ebenezer Obey, and Sunny Ade were at their wailing peaks, Nigerian society was feeling the benefits of its oil industry and relative stable politics. Unlike Fela Kuti's angry, activist Afrobeat, juju was communal, celebratory, and the bands kept getting bigger and bigger. On the new Ade retrospective Gems from the Classic Years, his band features two guitars besides his own leads, bass, trap drums, two variable-tone talking drums, congas, bongos, two percussionists, and a chorus of four to back up Ade's lead vocals. And in concert, there might be added drummers and a half dozen dancers. There's a lot to follow in full-flight juju. It might be overwhelming if Ade didn't also write vivid, memorable hooks and melodies, as in this crossover version of his hit, Ja Fume. Those new to Sunny Ade should start with the anthology King of Juju on the British Rass label. That's Rasse, like the fish. This album cherry-picks tracks Ade released on Island and Mango Records when label head Chris Blackwell was trying to make him the next big thing. The Western market wasn't ready, but the music hasn't dated at all. Not only does every track feature a bold, clear hook from voice or guitar, but the rhythm presentation is easier to get into than the older Nigerian mixes. More bass, less talking drums. But once juju unfolds for you and you begin to enjoy following the mingling and separating lines of voices, guitars, drums, ensemble, and solos, it's the old Nigerian performances you'll pull out to play. The first Shaniki collection from 2003 is called The Best of the Classic Years, and it really is. Every track punchy and powerful. The 18-minute original version of Synchro System perfectly demonstrates how juju is about flow, immersion, and erasing the sense of foreground and background. The new collection, Gems from the Classic Years, is sub-perfect, but emphasizes a prime series of medleys. These tunes morph beautifully into one another. The jam bands can forget it. But a standout is a 3-minute praise song called Dele Davis, punchy and to the point. American fans, I suspect, come to cherish Juju partly for the ways it's not like our pop tunes. But it's equally important that King Sonny understands the appeal of a 3-minute single.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. The latest of the King Sonny A Day collections is called Gems from the Classic Years. Fresh Air's executive producer is Genny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross, reminding you you can download podcasts of our program on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The popular and award-winning cop show, The Shield, is back with its 6th season. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with CCH Pounder. She plays Claudette Wims, who has just been promoted from detective to captain. Join us for the next Fresh Air.